Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And it is Thursday, that means open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. We're happy to take your questions on any aspect of Catholic faith, Catholic life, the church, the Bible, or really anything having to do with religion. Maybe you have a religious question that has nothing to do with Catholic, or may appear not to have anything to do with the Catholic Church. We're happy to take those questions. Our guest today is Jimmy Akin, the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And as you know, Jimmy's a prolific writer, and you can find out all about him at jimmyakin.com. But most recently, he is the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Become a Better Apologist.
Yeah.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy. How's it going, Si?
Very well. My second day.
Pleasure to be working together again.
Yeah. It's very nice. It has that permanent feel now.
Yeah. Not the tryout feel so
yeah,
much.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. So I just at random picked one of the questions.
Uh-huh.
So because it is 365 days plus one, so that covers the leap year and all.
Right.
But you don't have to do them in order. Like one of the fun things is just kind of leaf through it.
Yeah, you can flip through it. Now, it's designed to be read, you know, from front to back, but you can flip through it if you want. It's also not tied to the calendar. The days are just numbered day one, day two, day three, and so on.
Right.
So you can pick it up at any time and start reading, and you can binge read. You can read multiple days at once and not worry about getting out of sync with the calendar. So there's always something interesting in there to think about.
That's what I thought.
So what day did you pick?
I picked day 218.
Oh, I know that one.
And okay. And I'm going to read it.
Because we talked about it before the show. Yeah.
I'm going to read it in my grumpy voice.
Okay.
Christians are a bunch of hypocrites.
Your point being?
Which is essentially your answer, Eddie.
Yeah. Well, my answer in the book is yes, and...
Yeah, right.
And because I'm acknowledging, I start out by acknowledging, and this is one of those lines in the book that is deliberately humorous. You know,
yeah.
I use some humor in the book. So you'll be trundling along, and then all of a sudden there's a Mr. Spock reference or something, you know, that's meant to be funny.
Right.
But in this case, you know, the humorous remark has an important function, which is it acknowledges, sure, Christians are hypocrites.
Yeah.
Let's not deny that. Let's not, you know, argue. Let's not get into a contest about who's holier than whom. Because if you're dealing with a skeptic, they're not going to be impressed by, you know, a who's holier than whom contest.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to do is get out in front of the issue, acknowledge it. Yep, we're hypocrites. And then build from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I then do is to say, you know, all people have a sense that they are not what they should be. And they're consequently all tempted at times to either shade the truth in their favor or to outright lie in their favor and
right.
make themselves seem better than they are. And so hypocrisy is a human universal. It's something all people have. And in the face of hypocrisy, there are basically three strategies you can use. The first strategy, when you realize I don't live up to my own standards, is say, okay, I'm going to chuck my standards.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just be immoral. I'm not going to try to be moral anymore. And that's obviously a not good strategy, to just chuck your standards when you don't live up to them. The second strategy is to say, okay, even though I don't live up to my standards, I'm going to pretend I do to other people and, you know, and use deception
mm-hmm.
to make myself seem better than I am. And that's the hypocrisy strategy. And so that's also not good. The third strategy is the good one. And the third strategy is also the hardest. The third strategy is to be honest about, yeah, I'm a sinner. I don't live up to my own standards. Now, that doesn't mean telling everybody the details of what, you know, what your struggles are. That can be a big mistake. You know, sometimes in marriages, people have the idea we need total openness between spouses. And actually, that's not the case.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
right.
But it does mean acknowledging, being willing to acknowledge, yeah, I'm not what I should be. I'm a sinner and I don't live up to my own standards, but I'm going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And then ask God to give you the grace you need to live up to your standards better. And so that's the good strategy. But it's also the hardest because it means being humble and turning to God for grace. And so even though hypocrisy is a human universal, the good news is that there's mercy even for hypocrites like us.
Amen. The book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Become a Better Apologist. You can get that on Catholic.com. Jimmy, what's the difference between being a hypocrite and just being a bad Christian though?
Like a bad Christian would be somebody who is a Christian that does wrong. Hypocrite would be a Christian hypocrite would be a Christian who does wrong and then lies about it.
Ah, yeah, yeah, okay. I've been both of those.
Well, we all have been.
Yeah, right. I'm going to try strategy three now, though.
Awesome.
I'm going to try moving on to strategy three.
Good
888-31. Yes, thanks. Well, you know, I have assistance in that regard, and that is, we're not on our own.
Got a new service that helps out with that?
Well, yes, it's called the sacraments.
Okay, there you go.
I've been noticing they produce good fruit sometimes. All the time, I guess, if I'll let them.
If we let them.
888-31-TRUTH is the number. The number that is 888-318-7884. Any question you've got on Catholic life or faith or anything having to do with religion for Jimmy Akin today, we start with Jay in Fort Worth, Texas. Listening on EWTN, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Jay, what's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Well, first off, thank you for taking my call. I really love your show. It just helps me through my day.
Well, thank you.
I've been listening, and I've heard people ask about birth control before, and we're in a kind of a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're practicing Catholics. We don't want to get anything between God and us. Mm-hmm. And synopsis is, we have two children. They were both difficult pregnancies. After the second one, which was a miracle, he made it to term. The doctor said, you guys are done. You're finished.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to cause, you know, death of the mother, death of the child, and prescribed birth control. And we've gone to our parish and asked, and they said, yes, it's okay because of the life and death situation. But where? You know, I'm a guy. Show me where. If it is or not, you know. So.
Mm-hmm.
Where can I find a definitive answer on this?
Well, the answer that you were given by your parish, I'm afraid, is not accurate. In order for one to be able to use a procedure, regardless of what it is, that has a contraceptive effect, a principle needs to be satisfied from moral theology known as the law of double effect. In ordinary English, the contraceptive effect of the procedure, whether it's taking a pill or having a surgery or whatever it may be, the contraceptive effect needs to be a side effect. That's the short answer. What it can't be is either a means or an end. Okay? So if you were saying, well, we don't want to have any more children, we just don't want them. So we're going to use contraception. In that case, the contraceptive effect would be something that was being used directly for purposes of achieving the end of not having any more children. It's exactly the thing you're intending. You want the contraceptive effect for its own sake. But your situation is different. You're not wanting it just to avoid having children. You're not wanting the contraceptive effect, or your doctor is not proposing using contraception as a way of not having more kids for its own sake. Instead, he's proposing that the contraceptive effect be used as a means towards a different goal. The goal is not having no more children, the goal is protecting your wife's life. And so in this case, the contraceptive effect is a means rather than an end. And so consequently, it doesn't satisfy the principle of double effect, and it wouldn't be permitted by Catholic moral theology. Let me give you an example where it would be. Suppose that a woman has uterine cancer, and the only way to cure the uterine cancer is to remove the uterus. Well, in that case, she's not going to be able to conceive children anymore. So there's a contraceptive effect to this surgery, but it's a side effect. You can tell that as a result of this procedure, she's going to be infertile, but you're not doing that in order to avoid having children for its own sake, and you're not keeping her from having children to protect her health. You're directly protecting her health, but as a side effect of that, she won't be able to have any more children. In other words, the not having more children is not a means to an end of protecting her health. It's simply a side effect. And so in the case of uterine cancer, a hysterectomy could be legitimate in principle. But that's not what's happening in your situation. In your situation, the doctor's proposing that you don't have any more children because doing so would potentially harm your wife's health. And so it makes it a means to an end and thus fails the law of double effect. So that's how an Orthodox Catholic moral theologian would parse this. If you'd like documentation on that, I'd suggest one of two places. The first one is the Couple-to-Couple League. They specialize in natural family planning, and their experts will tell you the same thing I just did. Or if you want to go a more scholarly route, the place to go would be Couple-to-Couple League is more practically oriented. If you want to go to a more scholarly oriented group, I'd suggest the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Massachusetts. And their website is ncbcenter.org. The Couple-to-Couple League's website is ccli.org. And both of them are Orthodox Catholic groups that will be able to explain the principles. And particularly in the case of the Couple-to-Couple League, they can help you and your wife find out about some alternatives to contraception that can be very effective. Also, I'd say one thing I would do if I was in this situation is talk to another doctor who's pro-life and get a second opinion, because there are a lot of doctors out there who are terrified of being sued. And so in a situation where there could be some risk, they may exaggerate the risk for purposes of staying out of the situation altogether and going with the easy solution of let's just use contraception. And so I would get a pro-life doctor's second opinion about how much risk really is here, and then what are our options that are consistent with Catholic principles.
Okay. So the natural family planning sounds to me like the only route that we have. Is that correct?
Assuming in principle, I mean, artificial contraception is not going to be a legitimate option in this case, not based on at least the fact pattern you described. If there's something else about the fact pattern, you know, that could come up in a Couple-to-Couple League or National Catholic Bioethics Center consultation. But based on the fact pattern you described, artificial birth control isn't going to be an option. So if you, and to the extent you do, need to avoid pregnancy, natural family planning or abstinence are going to be your options.
Okay.
Thank you, Jay.
All right. Thank you, sir.
And, you know, we can encourage our listeners to pray for Jay and his wife. Very, very difficult situation. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with Open Forum. We're taking any question you've got on Catholic life or faith. Jimmy Akin is our guest today. I'm Cy Kellett. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a very special offer for all of you who are interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as possible involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. I wrote this book specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue with the goal of persuading others, to help you to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or go to the shop at catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 3:7, Jesus withdrew to the sea. A large crowd had followed him from Galilee and Judea. He told his disciples to have a boat ready for him so they wouldn't crush him. While the scribes and Pharisees closed their minds and hearts to him, the common people who were hurting recognized that he was no mere popular preacher. He had power that could heal. When I sit at the computer each day to answer questions on our Ask an Apologist forum, I look first to answer questions from the people who seem to be hurting. These are the people that our Lord spent himself on the most. They are always the ones most open to him. Actually, at times we are such people. We all hurt at one time or another. What great value our hurts are for us. It is only when we recognize our need for him that we are humbled and come to him as the children he knows us to be. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum today with our guest, Jimmy Akin. We go to David in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on 94.9 FM. David, what's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Yeah, hey. So I have a question about the metal scapular.
Okay.
And I do not mean a scapular metal, because I know they make like a round scapular metal.
Right.
But I've seen these scapulars that are made of metal.
Okay.
And from what I've read, like on the Carmelite
metal with a T, not a D.
With a T.
Yeah.
Yes. As in tinker. And from what I can tell, it says that a scapular must be made of wool.
Okay. What is saying? What is saying that? What is saying a scapular must be made of wood?
Sisters, wool. The Carmelite website.
Okay.
Sisters of.
Okay, go
their
ahead.
Orders website, yeah.
Okay.
But they sell all these metal scapulars.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like they wouldn't be selling them all over the place. Maybe they would, but, you know, somebody would have put a stop to it already, you know, if they weren't legit.
So you want to know, is this
so
okay?
I was calling to see if you knew anything.
I don't know a lot in this area. What I can say is that there are different scapulars for different orders. And so it's going to depend on which scapular you're talking about. So it may well be that Carmelite scapulars have to be made of wool, but that doesn't mean all scapulars would have to be made of wool. There could be other groups that have, or even other groups of Carmelites that have, regulations that allow for the for making scapulars of various materials, including things other than wool. And that could include metals, M-E-T-A-L-S. Obviously, metals are often made of metal, although I've also seen plastic metals.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah.
But is it a plastic then? Do you call it a plastic or you still
call
it a metal?
Well, sure. It's a plastic metal, M-E-D-A-L, yeah. Plastic metal. But and I don't know, we're getting into some modern material science, but I guess you could have plasteel. You sometimes read about that in science fiction. That would be plastic metal with a T.
Yep.
But I don't know anyone who's made a scapular out of that yet. I do know that there are metal scapulars being sold, and I would assume that that they're approved by the different groups that that are the sponsors of the scapulars. The only way to be sure, though, would be to take a particular metal scapular and identify the relevant sponsoring religious group and contact their headquarters and say, what can you tell me the regulations on this are? But I, given the fact that these are out there, and certainly there's nothing intrinsically wrong. It's just a matter of what are the regulations. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with having a metal scapular. I wouldn't be at all surprised if there were religious organizations that do authorize metal scapulars.
Okay, David?
For the brown scapular, would the correct order be Our Lady of Mount Carmel, the Sisters of Our Lady of Mount Carmel.
That would be my understanding, but even then, there are different groups of Carmelites, and so, you know, you got to be kind of careful about who you're talking to. And actually, just because something's on a website doesn't necessarily mean it's official. So if you really want to pursue this, you're going to probably need to go, you know, contact an expert who belongs to this group. And the way I would do that is a frontal assault. I'd call the home office of the group and ask who I should talk to about this.
Fantastic. That's what I'll do.
Okay.
Thank you, David. We go to Trent in Groom, Texas, listening on 1360 AM. Trent, you are on with Jimmy Akin. What's your question?
Oh, okay. My question is, I just finished reading a book by John Michael Talbot about Christian mystics and their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a chapter about a piece of work called The Way of the Pilgrim.
Okay.
Apparently is very popular in Eastern Catholicism.
Okay.
And he mentioned that he feels like, even though he is a Latin Rite Catholic, he feels like sometimes we miss some of the more mystical parts of the Eastern Catholicism.
Okay, so what's your question for me, Trent?
My question is there a theologically sound way that as a Latin Rite Catholic, we might be able to experience some of that more mystical side that the Eastern Church seems to emphasize more?
Oh, well, the if by mysticism you mean direct experience of the supernatural, then that's something that's also part of the Western Catholicism as well. I mean, there's a long tradition of Western mysticism in addition to Eastern mysticism. Is it mysticism in particular you're interested in, or is it Eastern Catholicism?
It's just some of the aspects that the Eastern Church emphasizes more. I don't want to join the Eastern.
Okay.
Right.
Well, okay. In that case, there are any number of options. I mean, you can start reading books about Eastern saints. You could go to Mass and or Divine Liturgy in an Eastern Catholic church. You could even do that on a regular basis. You could use Eastern prayer devotions like the Akathist hymn. You could read books by Eastern church fathers. You could do any number of things. Now, if it's not the Eastern experience, you could use Eastern icons. There's all kinds of things you could do. If you're not specifically interested in the Eastern side of things but in mysticism, you could also explore Western mysticism. There are books on mystical theology that are written by Western theologians who are Catholic. There are Western mystics whose lives you could study, and there are, you know, meditative practices where one can open oneself to God, and He may or may not choose to give you a particular experience. There's on the website for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, there's a document called An Instruction on Some Aspects of Christian Meditation that you could take a look at that deals with some of that. So there's a bunch of different things you could do, and I'd encourage you to explore them and see what speaks to you and what God might use in your journey.
Okay.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Okay.
Is it somewhat accurate that the Eastern Church emphasizes mysticism more?
I think that that's something that is a subjective assessment. It may have been true in the last few years, but historically both Eastern and Western Catholic churches have had a strong component of mysticism. So I think it depends on which circles you run in and when you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you very much, Trent. And Jimmy, real quick, you said Eastern Catholic churches. Could you just maybe name
Yeah,
one
sure.
Or two,
the Maronite Church, the Byzantine Catholic Church, the Chaldean Catholic Church, Melkite Catholic Church. There would be a number of them.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Happy to take your questions on any aspect of Catholic life or faith. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Jimmy Akin is our guest. This is Catholic Answers Live, and we'll be right back.
Catholic Answers Live.
It's been called a crash course in salvation history, the perfect addition to CCD and RCIA reading lists. Catholic Answers' new graphic novel, The Big Picture, has set the Catholic book world on fire with its unique and innovative blend of apologetics and entertainment. With high-quality, full-color illustrations and a storyline that's easy to follow, The Big Picture reveals a story full of passion, suspense, adventure, and hope, engaging the reader immediately as our heroes come face-to-face with the drama and mystery of God's plan for the salvation of the world. It gets readers talking and thinking, captivating and entertaining them with eternal truths presented in a non-threatening way. Get your friends and family talking about things that matter. Order your copy of The Big Picture today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about my new book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. Have you ever read something in the Bible that confused you? Or has a skeptic ever asked you to explain a scandalous passage and you didn't know what to say? Doesn't Genesis contradict science? Why does the Bible promote slavery? How could God order his people to kill women and children? It's happened to just about everyone. But now you have a place to turn for the answers. In Hard Sayings, I look at dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture and offer clear, reasonable, and Catholic keys to unlocking their true meaning. After reading this book, you'll be equipped to answer the toughest questions skeptics ask about the Bible. So don't be left without an answer again. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum today because it is Thursday. And, well, I guess we could put open forum on any day. It's not because it's Thursday. It's just that it is Thursday and it's open forum on Thursdays. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And we will go to Paul in Los Angeles, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Paul, thank you for your call. What's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Hi. thank you for taking my call. I have heard it said that at the hour of death, both Christ and Satan are present, and both are competing for your soul. Is that right?
We don't have any indication that that's literally true. It is true that Christ is always available to us and is always hoping for our salvation and always giving us his grace, rather than hoping, I should say, always desiring our salvation. And it's also true that the forces of darkness are always opposed to us and are always trying to cause us to be lost. And so both of those continue right up to the end of our life. And it's at the end of our life that the final, final life answer is made. And so one way of depicting that is as if Jesus and Satan are both battling for your souls at the moment of death. There's a spiritual principle or set of spiritual principles that's true, because it is at this moment that you must make your ultimate choice between God and between choosing God and rejecting God. So there's a sense in which there is this spiritual battle going on right up to the hour of death, which is the crucial moment. However, it doesn't mean necessarily that Jesus is invisibly in the room with you, other than the way he's normally present everywhere anyway, as the second person of the Trinity. He's omnipresent, so he's everywhere. The devil isn't everywhere, but he does have, you know, influence in lots of places, including through his servants, the subsidiary demons. And Christ also sends angels, good ones, to do things to help people. So, you know, there could be a good angel there and a bad angel there, but we don't even actually have evidence for that. It would just be a matter of speculation. But the struggle spiritually for our souls is something that is real and goes on throughout our lives, and the final moment of life is the crucial one.
Okay, I get it. It's struggle all the way to the bitter end, isn't it?
Indeed, and hopefully the end won't be so bitter.
There's no reason to assume that the end would be bitter.
Yeah.
I mean, it is true that we have record of saints dying peacefully.
Joyfully.
Yeah. So, yeah, right. There's no – I don't think, Paul, that we have to assume that the end is bitter at all.
No, but I think he was probably just using an expression.
Yeah.
The very end is often to the bitter end.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Christina in Worcester, Massachusetts, listening on Emmanuel Radio. Thank you for calling to Mac. Oh, excuse me. Thank you for calling. Oh, sorry, I almost did that.
That's
okay. I have a really good question for you.
Okay.
I purchased your DVD on Understanding Revelation.
Oh, awesome.
And I have to commend you on that. It's an excellent DVD, but I have a question.
Okay.
Regarding the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's going to happen in the future, or are there signs that we need to look for those four horsemen of the apocalypse?
Okay.
I know it's war, pestilence, death, and I think there was one more I remember on that.
Yeah.
Are there signs that we have to look for, or is this something that's already happened, or I just need that answer.
Well, I'll give you my perspective. So the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the first one is I'll do this real briefly, but for people who may not be familiar, in the book of Revelation, or the Apocalypse, as it's also called, John the seer sees a sequence of four horsemen and their riders. And the first horse is white, and seated on it is a conqueror who comes out with a bow, and he's given the ability to conquer. And second is a red horse that has a sword and is given the ability to take peace from the earth. The third horse is black and has a pair of scales, and John hears an audible message that indicates that wheat and barley and, you know, grains like that have become fantastically expensive by the standards of the ancient world. And then the last horse, it actually says green in Greek. The word is chloros, which is the same place we get chlorophyll. But the green horse is explicitly identified as death. And so when you look at this sequence of symbols, there's a debate about who the first horse is. Some people, because later we see Christ in Revelation riding a white horse, although he has a sword on that occasion, not a bow. A lot of people have said, okay, the first horse is Christ. The second horse, since it's red and takes peace from the earth, is obviously war. The third horse is black and has the scales with the fantastically expensive food, so that's famine. And then the last horse is death. And so that's who they are. Now, there's another interpretation of the first horse, which is the white one where they got the conqueror with the bow. That doesn't have to be Christ. You know, there are a lot of people in history who've ridden white horses. Gandalf, the Lone Ranger.
Is Gandalf in history? Is Gandalf
in literary history.
Okay.
And so there are a lot of people also who have been kind of false images of Christ. Like, Augustus Caesar liked to be known as the Son of God.
Right.
Okay. And Domitian, another Roman emperor, had people refer to him as my Lord and my God. So there's a kind of satanic echo of Christ in the Roman system. And so this could be a nasty Roman pagan false Christ conqueror like Nero Caesar, who also shows up in Revelation as the beast of Revelation. So which one – you can have your own opinion, Si, but to me the sequence pagan emperor leads to war – leads to famine, leads to death,
makes
more sense than Jesus Christ leads to war, leads to famine, leads to death.
Right.
So I would say that given the fact that the rest of the book of Revelation says it's about things that are going to happen soon from John's perspective, we need to look to most of the events in Revelation as having their primary fulfillment either in the first century or in the first few centuries. So I would say that what the four horsemen of the apocalypse symbolize in their primary sense is the conflict that the ambition and warlike nature of the Roman emperors led to in the first century, not only in the leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in the AD 60s, but also in the year of four emperors, where you had a massive series of rapid civil wars in Rome at the exact same time as Jerusalem was under siege. This was in 68 at a slightly earlier stage in the war, 68, 69, so that you had Nero and Galba and Otho and Vitellius just rapidly taking office and seizing it from each other. And it was a very violent period, and I think that's what's being talked about. So I think the primary period we're talking about here with the Four Horsemen is first century, not in our future. Having said that, I think this also articulates a familiar historical pattern where the ambition of rulers leads them to war, which leads to famine, which leads to death. And so this is something we have to perennially be on the lookout for, because even though the primary fulfillment may have been in the first century, there can be other fulfillments in other ages as well, including in our future.
Does that work for
you?
Thank
you so much to me. And like, oh, that was great. And like I said, the DVD was super.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the whole, like you said, too, there's a lot of symbolism, you know, in the Revelation book also. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, I commend you on that DVD. It was excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christina. Boy, I that did make a lot of sense. The Gandalf part, no.
Well,
but the kind of false, we do as a species kind of keep following false messiahs. That's part of a symptom of being human, isn't
it? Yeah. Also, and this is something I actually mentioned on the DVD, white horses are often used by rulers, by political rulers.
Right.
Not just because they look cool, but apparently, at least this is what they said in my horsemanship class, white horses have better eyesight than other horses. And so if you're a horse, you know, your whole survival strategy is based on running away from things.
Yeah.
There's some danger, you're going to run away from it. And so you would therefore want your pack or herd to have someone with good eyesight that would serve as the warning. And so white horses get more street cred from other horses because they're better scouts.
Because they're the good leader then. They kind of symbolize those.
Yep.
Yeah. I think I may be part horse. Running away from trouble is my strategy, Jimmy. That's my primary life strategy. If I see my eyesight is failing, though. I don't know if that strategy is going to keep working.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be right back.
You're human. You've got multiple strategies to use.
Yes, that's true. That's right. 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. If you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, any question on Catholic life or faith, we're happy to take it during Open Line Forum. This is Catholic Answers Live, and we'll be right back.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
With his new DVD, Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book, Jimmy Akin unlocks the secrets of Revelation so that anyone can understand them. Packed with almost 2 hours of eye-opening material, it paints an entirely different picture of the book of Revelation than the one most people already have. The book of Revelation was meant to reveal God's message to his church. And in Understanding Revelation, Jimmy Akin shows you how it does exactly that. Order your copy of Understanding Revelation today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teens spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a very special offer for all of you who are interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as possible involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. I wrote this book specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue with the goal of persuading others, to help you to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or go to the shop at catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And it is open forum on Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin today, author most recently of A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. You probably know this, but January is Sanctity of Life Month, with the marches for life happening and all over the nation this week and next week too. For the month of January, Catholic Answers is making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issues, available for only $5. That's extraordinary. That's 70% off the usual price of the book. And there really is no better resource available to equip yourself to answer questions put to you from those who support abortion. We're at almost 2,000 copies sent out. We'd like to send some more out. Mm-hmm. Can you pick that up on – you can go to Catholic.com or you can give a call to 888-291-8000 and they will tell you how you can get
– I can?
What?
I can?
You can. Yes.
Oh, good. You,
oh, nice. I wasn't Sweet. Actually speaking directly to you, Jimmy. Oh. This
well,
microphone
I just kind of
is connected
out for a minute, and then I hear the pronoun.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So you, Jimmy Akin, or anyone else can call 888-291-8000. But if you want to talk to Jimmy Akin, don't call that number. Call 888-31-TRUTH. We go now to Cody in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Cody, what's your question for Jimmy?
Oh, first of all, I just want to extend my welcome to the new guest. I forget your name, but welcome to the job.
And, oh, that's me, Cy. Yeah.
New host.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm an old guest.
Are you the one who hosts The Bright Side?
I did. Yes, I did indeed. Thank you. Wow. I'm very impressed. Your knowledge is impressive.
But he's an Immaculate Heart listener in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm blind. All I do is listen.
Well, all I do is talk, so we go together well. What's your question for Jimmy?
Okay, I'm curious about how close the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church are in particular to coming into full communion with one another. I've read some articles recently that suggest that there is still a lot of work to do. I mean, I know, of course, the Lutheran Church has invalid sacraments such as communion, but I do realize that we have a lot in common with them. Their mm-hmm. services are very similar to the Mass. I know that because I've been to many Lutheran services, mm-hmm. and I'm curious because I'm
okay. I've got the
from
question.
What I'm reading, there isn't much difference between the two, and I'm curious how
where
close
we are.
We are to
okay, so there are differences between the two. Now, after at the time of Vatican II and shortly after, there was a lot of speculation about some kind of imminent reunion with Lutherans. There were Catholic theologians, including Joseph Ratzinger, who suggested that if you had a proper reading of the Lutheran Augsburg Confession, that it wouldn't be a problem, that you could be in union with the Catholic Church. And so there was discussion of, hey, maybe it would be possible to kind of create a Lutheran rite of the Catholic Church where they'd have a properly Catholic theological understanding of various issues but still have their own form of tradition in terms of how they lived out the Christian life. So not unlike the way we now have an Anglican use in the Catholic Church. So there was a big hope for that at the time, but reality settled in and it realized, no, we're not that close. We can't reunite imminently. And unfortunately, the record since then has been mixed. There's been a lot of ecumenical dialogue between Catholics and Lutherans, and we've grown closer in some ways. For example, probably the most famous thing in that regard is the signing of the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification, where we professed a very similar pair of understandings of how justification works. We don't agree on absolutely every point, but we're much closer than was commonly recognized even a few decades ago. And so there's been a convergence in that respect, but there's also been divergence since the Second Vatican Council, in particular because, among other things, Lutherans have accepted female clergy, and that creates a problem for reconciliation with the Catholic Church that didn't exist back at the time of the Second Vatican Council. So in some ways we've grown closer, in some ways we've grown farther apart. Don't expect it to happen next week or even in our lifetimes, but hopefully someday. And, you know, it might take a century or two. It might take longer. It may not happen before Jesus gets here. But eventually, when Jesus gets here, all Christians will be reunited.
Yeah, the reason I was curious is because I have a very positive relationship with a Lutheran church in my hometown. They know I'm Catholic, and they know I don't take communion with them. They're very respectful, but mm-hmm. I knew them before I became a Catholic, and I'm a musician, so occasionally I go Sunday mornings to play with them in their music ministry after Mass. Mm-hmm. And I would look forward to seeing the day when we can all share communion with one another. But
right. Well, that's probably how it's going to happen by befriending one another, wouldn't
you say? That's part of the process.
Cody, thank you so much for that call. Aldo in Green Bay, Wisconsin, listening to on the Catholic Answers Live app. What is your question for Jimmy Akin, Aldo?
Hello. My question was, how do dogmas come to be and when were they made?
Okay. First, we need to start out with what a dogma is. A dogma is a truth that must be both divinely revealed and it must be infallibly defined by the church as something that's divinely revealed. So those are the two conditions. The first condition was fulfilled, if it was fulfilled, before the death of the last apostle. That's when God was giving public revelation. And so if it's got to be either in scripture or tradition, it's got to be in there either explicitly or implicitly in the deposit of faith, the deposit of revelation that was passed on to the church by Christ and the apostles. The second condition where the church infallibly says, not only is this true, but it's also divinely revealed, that's something that can happen at any point in church history. And so it's happened at quite a number of different points, actually. One of the most obvious examples is the First Council of Nicaea in the year 325 AD, infallibly defined and as a matter of divine revelation that Jesus of Nazareth is not only Christ, but also is the Son of God and is the second person of the Trinity. So the fact that Christ is divine in the full sense, that's something that became a dogma no later than AD 325. You could even argue it was defined earlier by the ordinary magisterium of the church, but it was certainly defined in AD 325. And then many times throughout church history, it will be an ecumenical council that issues an infallible definition of a point of revelation that makes it a dogma. It can be done other ways. It can be done through just the ordinary teaching of the bishops in union with the Pope, even when they're not gathered in an ecumenical council, and it can be done by the Pope himself. So there have been a variety of points in history where this has happened. The most recent was in 1950 when Pope Pius XII defined the Assumption of Mary. And so that's the most recent dogma. It was made 67 years ago, but it's happened at a variety of points, and those are the mechanisms by which it happens.
Aldo?
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
God bless.
You too. Thank you. Thank you very much. Aldo, Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada, also listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. What's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Hi. Hi, Jimmy. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
And I heard an objection to the inspiration of Paul. You know, that, you know, this person seems to question Paul just because, you know, some of the things he must have written were cultural, and he said that, you know, they don't apply today.
Okay.
And sometimes they seem to be in conflict with the gospel. So my question is, how do you answer, say, a person who says that Paul's teachings were, it's a cultural, you have to take it in a cultural context, and it's not really an eternal
gotcha.
One.
Gotcha.
Thanks, Mark.
So the basic answer is every document is written in a culture. Everything is in a cultural context. That's true not just of Paul's writings, but of all the writings in the Bible, including the Gospels. And so the mere fact that something was written in a particular time and has things that apply to that culture but not necessarily to other cultures doesn't mean that it's not divinely inspired. If it did mean that, then we would have no divinely inspired documents because every single one of them has culturally determined things in them. In fact, the very language that they're written in is an artifact of culture. Culture is one of the – or I should say language is one of the primary artifacts of a culture, the language it speaks. And so New Testament Greek and Judean Aramaic and prior to that Biblical Hebrew, those were all elements of the culture that determined the way Scripture was written. It was written in those languages. And so even the act of translating the Scriptures into English is something where we take an artifact of one culture that's divinely inspired and we discern its meaning and bring that over into our culture. And so that doesn't mean using all the same words that are there in Hebrew. If it did mean that, then it wouldn't be translating. But we're taking the meaning behind the Hebrew words and bringing that into English. And there's something similar that happens with the theological content of these documents. For example, one of the laws in the Law of Moses in the Old Testament was that you have to build rails around the roof of your house. And you might wonder, why do you have to do that? Why do you need rails on the roof of your house? Well, in ancient Israel, it was cool up on the roof, particularly in the evening, and they would go up there and hang out on the roof, and they'd sleep up there, and they'd recreate up there. If you may notice in Acts chapter 10, Peter goes up on the roof while he's waiting for a meal to be prepared. And so you had people up on the roof regularly. And so as a safety measure, it made sense to have rails around the edge of your roof. Now, most people today don't hang out on their roofs. And so most of us today don't need rails around our roof. But we do need – we can take that principle and apply it in other contexts that do make sense in our culture, such as having rails around or fences around swimming pools or other dangerous places. Or if you've got a really tall building that people do go out on the roof of, yeah, okay, put rails around it or something to keep them from falling off. So we can – even though most people in our culture, the roof rail rule – there's a tongue twister. Doesn't apply. The principle still can, and that's just part of the process of taking something from the Bible and translating it into its appropriate application today.
Thanks, Mark, very much, and thank you, Jimmy, because I can now take the rails off my roof.
Yeah.
They look ridiculous.
Well, and they're so expensive.
And that is, you know, the upkeep?
Yeah.
And come on.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, still have to keep people who come on my property safe.
Yeah.
That's the basic principle.
You want them to be safe.
Yeah. All right.
So you better get rid of that, you know, snake bit too.
Oh, come on, Jimmy. Put
a rail around it.
You need to show me a Bible quote to back that up I can't have my snake pit anymore.
Will do.
Thanks, Jimmy Akin. It's really fun.
Likewise.
To do an hour open forum. Next hour, Father John Trigilio here with you, with all of us, actually. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.